This is the John Clayton Show.
Brought to you by Coors Light, the world's most refreshing beer.
On 710 ESPN Seattle.
And good morning, everybody, on this Saturday morning. Again, watching the snow continuing to melt. We just have little traces right now. Hopefully by the midweek, I know there's a threat of another storm coming through. Let's hope that doesn't happen. Let's hope that it stays above 32, 35 degrees so we don't have to go through this again. I mean, just thinking about last week and what a nightmare it was. I mean, what power goes off at 8:30 in the morning here at my place. And, of course, fortunately, thanks to the app, I was able to do the show, even though it got colder and colder downstairs trying to do it. But we've got 3 hours of fun talk here. 866-979-ESPN, 206-421-ESPN. Let's get going with some headlines. Well, Mariners get some bad news. Malik Smith now has an elbow problem. His right elbow has been bothering him for the last week or so. So they're going to kind of shut him down for at least 2 or 3 weeks. And so one of the main acquisitions is going to be missing a good portion of spring training. And, of course, this is the day today where they're going to be out there on the field with the first workout with the full team. So that's bad news on that one front. Also, they had their 15th best prospect ended up having to get some knee surgery, a meniscus, so he's going to be down for some time. So, you know, a little bit of an ominous start right now for the Mariners in the season of trying to get younger, that two of the younger guys, a 15th best prospect and one of their best acquisitions, you know, down for the count for some time. Colin Kaepernick and Eric Reed were able to settle their case with the National Football League on collusion. No details have been allowed because, again, there's a confidentiality clause. But most people around the league think that Colin ended up getting more than $50 million from the National Football League. Eric Reed getting a lot less because he was able to get a deal done with the Carolina Panthers earlier this week, 3 years of $22 million. As far as news in the National Football League, you've got Glover Quinn being cut by the Detroit Lions, a former Pro Bowl safety, who's really been one of the mainstays of their defense. And so he's now going to be gone. And, you know, you've got more guys that have been told that they're not going to have their options picked up. I mean, and that's kind of a big blow to them. But, you know, there's going to be more free agent movement. Nothing on the Seahawk front at the moment. Still, there's Frank Clark trying to see if he can get a long-term deal. The likelihood is he's probably going to get the franchise tag. We got more deals that'll be trying to get done. But again, this is kind of an interesting time right now because each day there seems to be some movement on some things and some movement on anything else. But overall, it's going to be a very interesting off season. And I'm also looking forward to, in 2 weeks, getting down and over to Indianapolis for the combine. Those are our headlines. 866-979-ESPN, 206-421-ESPN. Let's get started with JB in Renton. Hey, JB.
Mr. Clayton, I'm glad to hear that you got your lights back on, my friend. How you doing on this Saturday morning?
Doing well. How about you?
Well, I can't complain there. Like you said, things are starting to thaw out a little bit. Hopefully we can get back to a little normal. I'm hoping to, like you also. We don't need to see another round of this stuff.
No. I think we're all kind of sick of it. It's just not fun,
we're good
not
to
good.
Go on that. You were talking about Colin Kaepernick and Eric Reed.
Yeah.
Now, do you think the NFL just settled on that situation so they can try to make it go away?
Yes. Yeah, because what's going to be interesting to see is that, because Eric was able to get a job and was young enough to do, and, you know, and he was willing to pay, go for a low salary and all that stuff, where Colin has not. And but first off, I mean, you kind of figured that, it would be hard for the league to, owner to want to sign Colin while he's, you know, suing him. When you sue your bosses, that tends to usually put you in a bad state. But also, there is a reality there that for Colin to get back in the league, he's 31 years old. He probably is thinking, hey, I'm a starting quarterback. I should be paid $20 million. But he would have to come in on a lower salary to kind of reprove himself. Because remember, he was 4-20 in his last 24 starts. So that didn't necessarily go well. But I think what ends up happening, and you see these in a lot of cases, and sometimes it frustrates me because, you know, these cases where you have, different lawsuits coming in where they're going for discovery and trying to get the financial statements of teams, that's usually when the league encourages the owners to say, you know, you got to settle this thing. You saw it happen with Tom Benson's situation down in New Orleans. You know, right when they're all set to get the documents out there, they end up getting a settlement. So I think in this case, that with this thing all heading toward a trial where there was going to be a lot of things out there, and again, they would have probably won the league in trial. because a collusion is a hard thing to prove. But also, there may be more damage by some of the emails, some of the text, some of the conversations that might come out that would make the league look bad. So what they basically did is paid Colin and Eric to let it go away.
Wow, and Eric also got him a 3-year deal with the Carolina Panthers.
Right. See, I'm thinking. I think Kaepernick got between 50 and 80 million bucks.
Oh, unbelievable!
Yeah, not bad,
I'm
huh?
But
again, I think he also did this on the agreement that he would not try to come back into the National Football League.
Didn't the new league try to sign him up?
Yes, they did. But what happened, at first, when he asked them for $20 million, and thinking about this, remember, the league came after both he and Tim Tebow and said, hey, would you want to play in this league? And when the story came out that he was asking for $20 million, I'm thinking, oh, this guy just doesn't want to play. Now we know why he was asking for $20 million, because if he would have taken that deal with the AAF, right, for less money,
right,
he probably wouldn't be able to get the 20, the 50 million to 80 million bucks. Because my read on it is he probably gets a settlement of 20 million for the 20 million a year for the 2 years he's out, and then future 20 millions for being out and not coming back in the league. Now again, I don't know. I mean, I'm just speculating. We're all speculating because this thing is in really a dark closet as far as confidentiality. They don't want this out. But, I think he probably signed and took the money. But, again, I thought maybe he was just saying he doesn't want to play football because, remember, the AAF is paying 3 years at $250,000, $83,000 a year, and they pay everybody the same. Well, in this case, I think that he took the tack that it's like, well, I'm not going to go down below $20 million and affect the settlement. And so he was able to get that. So he did the smart business thing, even though he made him look for about a day, look pretty bad and asking a league that pays $83,000 a year or a season for $20 million. But now you understand why.
Yeah, I definitely do understand why he did that. Let's get to a little bit of football. They got a few interesting cuts. The linebacker Marshall got cut, parted ways with the Broncos. Is that a cap situation?
Yes. It's a cap situation, and I mean, I think that you can see that so many of the moves that got the Broncos to the top and get them to the Super Bowl after they had lost to Seattle now is starting to starting to go apart. I mean, the Aqib Talib's no longer there. They made the move from getting that. So all those changes have come up to a point where it's like, okay, now we understand that Marshall is a good player, but also they have so much money tied up in the quarterback position, they had to make some sacrifices.
Okay, and also, Mr. Clayton, Demaryius Thomas got cut by the Houston Texans. What do you think about that? The ACL put tear, but, and I know it's pretty tough on a wide receiver to get back.
Mm-hmm,
but what
mm-hmm.
do you think about that?
Kind of a tough one, but an understandable. I mean, he's making $14 million a year, and, he wasn't going to be able to come back, and, he wasn't a $14 million player anymore. That was apparently the case from what you saw from the Denver Broncos, because they traded him. It was a move that didn't really do much as far as helping the Texans, but still, you make that move, and you do the best you can, but now it's going to be tough, because, I think he's not going to be he's in a worse situation than Richard Sherman, because Richard at least was, making the turn at 30 and 31. And, he goes there and you can see that as a cornerback and maybe eventually a safety, he still has many more years left. So he was able to get, $9 million this past year and then the option to get a little bit more. But what you're looking at for Demaryius, I think he's probably going to go down in the $5 and $6 million range. And because the injury happened so late, you don't know if he's going to be available for the start of training camp.
Is Antonio Brown and the Rooney's going to make up? I heard they had a little meeting. They got together and talked with each other.
Well, they talked, but I don't think it's going to lead to anything other than a trade. I think what it comes down to, it's like Art has to go to Antonio and say, hey, Antonio, we're going to trade you, but you got to shut up. And the reason that you're making it tough is, he leaks out that he wants a new contract, and he's making $17 million a year. Well, one of the things that's going to help in getting a trade and getting some value is that it fits under the cap if you make that deal. But if he now wants for more, that could lower his trade value.
Oh, yeah. Well, Mr. Cleet, we'll talk next Saturday, my friend. Duty calls.
Okay, sounds good. 866-979-ESPN, 206-421-ESPN. Give us a call. It's the John Clayton Show on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to the John Clayton Show on 710 ESPN Seattle and 710sports.com. Now, more John Clayton.
866-979-ESPN, 206-421-ESPN. Let's go to Raider Jim. Hey, Jim, how are you?
Hi, John. How are you this morning?
Better than last week, I can tell you that.
Right. We're all thawing out, and looks like it took you guys an extended period of time to just get back to normalcy.
Really did. I mean, because again, it's like when they don't plow the streets, it just turns into ice, and you don't have a four-wheel drive, you don't want to chance it.
Well, that's right, John. You know, I'm on the road a lot out here in Seattle, and I do have a four-wheel drive car, which is nice, but boy, the knuckleheads were out in force.
See, I mean, and that's the weird part because, I mean, growing up in Pittsburgh, I know how to drive in the snow, but when, you know, we do get the rock salt, which isn't used here, to try to melt some of the stuff. And, I mean, you saw that, I mean, when you're on the icy streets and there's nothing there that is taking it away, it doesn't get good. And, you know, back in Pittsburgh, I mean, they plow the secondary streets. Here they don't.
Right, right. Well, yeah, we just don't have the infrastructure for it. And especially in some of the outlying areas, like where you are down over there by the VMAC.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. Well, John, when is the schedule come out for franchising various players? Is that next week?
Yeah, it starts on the, I think, Tuesday.
Tuesday, okay. And then do the teams have a window?
They have until March the 5th.
Okay, so next week until March the 5th.
Right.
Okay, all right. How are talks progressing with the Seahawks and Frank Clark?
Not well. I'm sure it's slow because naturally, I know Joe Corey said that probably the best is when you have pass rushers like Jadeveon Clowney, DeMarcus Lawrence, Frank Clark, and those are the main three that are at that franchise level. I mean, it's almost like you're at the dance in high school and you're standing around looking to see who's going to be the first one that's going to be dancing. And so,
right.
You don't want to be the first one to get the deal done because, you may underestimate what you can get. My read on it now is that, and I think, I've been working on it all week, is that I think he's going to, he can get 5 years at 87.5, 17.5 a year. And, the franchise tag is going to be about $18 million. I'm sure that he's angling to try to get 20 to 21. And that's a fair position to be because Khalil Mack got 22, and see what Aaron Donald got. So, you don't want to underestimate. And so I think it's going to end up being a franchise tag.
Yeah, interesting. Interesting, John. Well, I wouldn't want to wish this upon any team as far as the dance that some of these players go through. I mean, that can come back to bite you in a bad way. I mean, last year we had the Aaron Donald situation come out, and then when Aaron Donald, when he signed that whopping deal with the Rams, then Khalil Mack and his agent kind of got they got their ideas wrapped around the fact that they could kind of be competitive with that. And there's nothing wrong with it, but if a team isn't ready to play ball or to pay according to those demands, look what happened.
Right. I mean, look at how bad it was for the Raiders. And I mean, the fact that Frank Clark as an individual player had as many sacks as the Raiders did as a team. 13.
Yeah. Well, Frank Clark had a great year. He's a beast. And the Seahawks, it'd be a shame to see him not in the Seahawks uniform, I must say, because he was a notable adversary this past year. And then John Gruden talked him up last year as well. So that couldn't, that further makes the case for Frank Clark. John, I was also going to ask you, have you done any analysis on coaching churn? Some coaches, I think organizations know that they want their coaches to succeed, and they're more than willing to give the other teams, other franchises, the authority to talk to various coaches if they're in play for a promotion with another team. But, lower-level coaches, like your secondary coach, your linebackers coach, or your strength and conditioning coach. Have you ever taken a look at that for a team and what that may mean for the management style of either the head coach or the franchise and what that means as far as their record?
Yeah, I mean, because I think when you constantly churn coaches, you're churning your roster and you're making things worse as opposed to getting better. And, I mean, you've seen it with the Raiders with a number, you know, because they did some one-and-dones and with when Al was alive. But the coaching churn is a bad one right now because, for example, there's only three offensive coordinators that have been with the team that they've been with more than 2 years. Think about that, only three.
Wow.
Okay, and then you look at the defensive coordinators, maybe you have seven or eight. And then, of course, you only have about maybe seven coaches right now that have been with their teams before like 2011. And, you know, two or three of those guys are on the hot seat. Dan Quinn, for example, he's on the hot seat. Ron Rivera is on the hot seat. Jason Garrett is on the hot seat. And so, you know, and you look and you say, okay, so what teams are up top? Well, Bill Belichick, he's been there since 2000. I mean, Pete Carroll, he's been there since 2010. And so the more you churn, the tougher it is because, you know, now you have, if you're a quarterback and you're getting a new offensive coordinator, that makes it tough. Now, naturally, the one churn that's happening now is that you have 20 offensive head coaches and 15 of them call their own plays. So you don't have that group that would be offensive coordinators that are coming through the ranks and are calling the plays. And so that's why you have like the Zach Taylors and the Cliff Kingsbury and guys like that, because that's the trend that's going on.
Yeah. Well, I make mention of it because I've been wondering, I've been pondering it. For instance, with the Raiders, their strength and conditioning coach was let go. Their running back coach went to go seek pastures elsewhere. The most notable one is the defensive backs coach who, and forgive me, I forget his name, but he came from the University of Alabama under Nick Saban's regime. And he was only there for a year, and then he goes to Tennessee. What wasn't clear to me in the report was which Tennessee team we talked about, University of Tennessee or Tennessee Titans. Either way, he's gone. And he was a notable acquisition. A lot of people wanted him on their team. And I just wonder what that means for the governance and the management style of John Gruden and Paul Gunther.
Probably doesn't help because, you know, you don't want that much of a churn of your coaching staff, particularly. But that's where one of the problems is when there's so many coaching changes. When you have eight coaching changes like it is this year or seven like it was the year before, what happens now, what's different than in the past is that, you know, there's no lateral. I mean, you can't make lateral moves if you're under contract or promotions to coordinators. And so now that limits the number of guys that are quality that you can get. And so that's why, you know, the coaches, you usually see what happens now is whether you're a good coach or a bad coach, for the most part, you go to a new team and, you know, they're going to make three or four changes the next year because, you know, you really didn't get as many quality candidates to fill in. Or if you got the quality candidates, maybe they'll go back to college, like in the case of the defensive back coach, or they'll be on the one-year deal and go someplace else. I mean, so, no, it's tough.
Yeah. And has the NFL given any thought to putting a moratorium on transactions for coaches until after the Super Bowl?
No, because I think that would be a bad thing, because if you do that, I mean, sure, it gives you a level playing field, but also it doesn't give the team trying to turn around hope that you can now get better, because at least, you know, you look at two of the staffs. I thought that Tampa Bay and Denver did a great job of putting their coaching staffs together. And so if you would have held that back, it'll be a free for all. And then you'd have one less month for everybody that didn't make the playoffs to be able to, you know, get on board in that. And because now you get the coaches signed in a big scramble, you're scrambling as far as trying to get the, you know, things ready for the combine, for the free agency. It's just, no, I think that it's better to do it this way. I mean, the only thing I think that they need to do is lighten up on the coaches that go to the Super Bowl. Let them announce it, you know, 2 weeks before the Super Bowl if they do it, and let them start to hire their staffs.
I agree with that, John. What about the Joe Flacco deal, John? What do you think about that for Denver? I think that's actually a good thing for Denver.
I do, too. Yeah, because you know, my read on it is that John Elway wants to draft Drew Locke from Missouri and, you know, have him with the 10th pick. But now they're in a position where if it is one where they don't get him and they don't like any of the other quarterbacks, they have Flacco for another year, and then they'll be in a position maybe the next year to get a quarterback. So it just gives them protection. And, you know, what I think people aren't thinking about, it was only a fourth-round pick.
Right. I think it makes very good sense for Denver. Mm-hmm. I think the Case Keenum experiment went awry, and they did what they could do. And I think that John is really scrambling now because he's got quarterback issues like right. a lot of franchises. He's no different. I mean, they staunched the bleeding, if you will, when they had Peyton Manning. But ever since then, and actually before that, they had problems.
Mm-hmm.
So with Joe Flacco, I mean, you've got a Super Bowl winning quarterback there who has quiet leadership. You know, and who gets the job done if given the opportunity. And I think that's a good acquisition for Denver, John.
I agree. No, I think that's good. Hey, thank you for the phone call.
Okay, John, take
All
care.
Right, let's go to Ricky in Bothell. Hey, Ricky.
Hey, good morning, John.
Good morning.
Hey, I got a couple questions for you.
Yeah.
Number one, do you think that the Seahawks are going to be able to get back to the top of the NFC West next year with these young coaches, these young kind of pass first coaches that are going to be coaching the opposing teams? And number two, do you think the Seahawks are going to spend the better part of the offseason here bolstering the defense?
Yeah, I think yes in both cases. Now, again, it's going to be a challenge because you're talking about a three-game difference at the moment. You know, and you look at the Rams, you know, I think so much of what's going to happen with them, you know, because you know they're not going to have Ndamukong Suh, LaMarcus Joyner, probably back. We'll see if they have to take any more cap hits. But their big one is going to be Andrew Whitworth. If he retires and they have, you know, the left guard, Roger Saffold, on the offensive line, his contract is up. If they lose the left side of the offensive line, that's going to be a dramatic step back. That could cost them two games. And so I look at the Rams right now as being, you know, still an 11-win, 12-win team. And Seattle's big thing is that if they can improve the defense, because they gave up like about 21.2 points a game, if they can take that mm-hmm. defense and get it to 18, then all of a sudden with the 26 that they score now, that probably puts them at that 10 or the 11 win and maybe the 12 win level. So I think they can narrow things down, but still it's going to be a challenge because the Rams just have a very good team.
Rams are pretty good. I feel like maybe they might take a step back next year,
they
though.
Will.
I think they might have overachieved a little this year. Cut. Okay, I got kind of a off-the-wall question a little bit for you about Colin Kaepernick.
Yeah.
I've always had a theory about him since after the NFC Championship game. All the talent in the world, I think Jim Harbaugh was a big part of his success, but I truly, in my heart, I truly believe that the Seahawks broke his competitive will. And even if he did get another chance to get on the field, I don't think we're going to see the guy that we saw before that had all that talent and looked like he was going to be a top-tier quarterback.
Yeah, I don't know if you would attribute it just to the Seahawks, but I think that there's no question there's a decline in his game. I mean, he was 4-20 in his last 24 starts, and you look at his numbers, and they weren't as good as they were when he was with Jim Harbaugh. And so it just kind of fell apart. And, you know, for him to come back, and this is in the stark reality, if you put the issue of the kneeling on the side, you know, what would happen was that he would have to come back at that RG3 level and take a low contract and try to work his way back, which I think he could because he was the most talented player on the market that was out there, but he had to reprove himself. And of course, you know, if you're now fighting a collusion case and you're trying to, you know, get the money, you're not going to come back and sign for $2 million on a 1-year deal. And that's what he would have had to do because, you know, he was not going to be in a position at 4-20 to be able to command the big money that, you know, maybe he deserved. But, you know, and that's just the reality because, you know, people were down on him as a player. We're not talking about just the things that he did off the field, kneeling and all that. But as a player, he was on the decline. And again, he could fix that. Other quarterbacks have fixed it. But, yeah, that's the reality of Colin Kaepernick. Hey, thank you for the phone call. 866-979-ESPN, 206-421-ESPN. Coming up next, Doug Farrar joining us. We'll talk some good football. It's the John Clayton Show, 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, more John Clayton on 710 ESPN Seattle and 710sports.com.
866-979-ESPN, 206-421-ESPN. Pleased to be joined by Doug Farrar and Doug, USA Today, and of course doing all the good stuff. And you just won an award. Has this fall and winter been any better for you? What award did you just win?
It was the... The Pro Football Researchers Association have a, I believe it's a Nelson Ross Award for recent contributions to football research. And gosh, a lot of people have like Michael McCambridge has won it, and Dan Daly has won it, and, you know, I won it the 2018 award for The Genius of Desperation, the book that was released last September, and it's an amazing honor. I heard about it 2 days ago, and I was just blown away. It was, it's an amazing thing that's happened.
Oh, and of course, I'm so proud of you. I mean, it's just and well earned too. And also, this is a chance to even plug your book again.
Well, yeah, we can do that. Yeah, The Genius of Desperation, a chronological schematic history of professional football from 1920 to the present. And, so I was on a podcast with Matt Williamson, who I know you know, yesterday. We were talking about the way, as quickly as the NFL is going schematically, I may have to do a second version in about 2 or 3 years. But, a book came out last September, and it's done very well. It's exceeded any expectations I've had, and certainly it's been a remarkable experience.
Well, that's great. I'm so proud of you. Congratulations, and definitely go everybody buy the book.
Thank you.
And so now let's go into the schematic changes that are happening, because, I mean, you're right. I mean, things are happening at such a quick pace. You go back, and I think, I mean, do you start with what Matt Patricia started to do in December 2nd with the Rams offense? You know, basically making sure that they had somebody at the edge of the defensive line to take away some of the, you know, quick the outside runs, and also try to take away some of the passes to the running backs, and then, you know, really try to focus on going in quarter coverage. And that, at least for about 3 weeks, people were picking up on that and slowing down the Rams and slowing down some of these high-powered offenses.
Right. Well, there are a couple things that happened with the Rams, and I think the Lions started it. And, of course, that Bears game was a disaster for Jared Goff, which I maintain he's not recovered from.
Mm-hmm.
They were running a lot of backfield action, you know, jet sweeps and things like that. And people must have done the math and realized that maybe about 10% of the time you're actually handing off to the sweep guy. Most of the time it's just window dressing to put your linebackers and your safeties in conflict situations. And eventually teams realized, okay, really, when Robert Woods is running a jet sweep, they're not usually going to hand it to him. And if they do, you can handle it on the edge. That was one thing. And what New England did in the Super Bowl, and other teams have done with Goff, is he's not yet a good field reader. It's, you know, last year was his third season. It takes time. New England was coming up to the line in one coverage and then going into another coverage after that 15-second thing where Sean McVay can't be in Goff's headset anymore, and Goff has to diagnose the read himself, or he has to diagnose the coverage himself. New England was changing coverage from 15 seconds left on the play clock to another coverage, and often it would be quarters. Sometimes it would be match. Sometimes it would be cover. Whatever it was, Goff would go up to the line of scrimmage seeing one coverage, and then New England would change it, or they'd disguise it. And it was an amazing chess match all the way through. So McVay's offense, the early advantage of it and the problem of it now is it's mostly 11 personnel, over 90%, and most of it pre-snap is pretty vanilla. It's the post-snap stuff where things get interesting. But, I mean, I remember being in the press box for that Super Bowl and thinking, they're not really doing anything different. It was a very kind of static overall set of schemes. I don't think they gave New England anything new that they hadn't seen on tape. And I wonder how much of that was the amount of stuff that Goff could actually handle.
Well, the one thing that I thought was brilliant, and this is what I'm wondering about where it's going to carry through, is that in some ways, Bill Belichick dusted off some of the old Buddy Ryan 46, but it wasn't the 46. Basically, it was a 6-1 because, you know, he took Patrick Chung and put him on the outside of the left defensive end, and then took Kyle Van Noy and put him on the right side. So now they had a coverage guy there, only one linebacker, but they had the flexibility of getting, you know, a lot of stunts there to take and force inside runs, but, you know, going into stunts.
Right, and, I mean, the principle of the 46 front, which wasn't Chicago's base defense back in the day, they were a 4-3 team, and Buddy would run the 46, mostly in passing situations, but the principle is you have a nose guard right over the center, and they, you know, New England has a couple of different guys who can do that. And then Dante Hightower and Kyle Van Noy as the, you know, sort of ends in that. Your ends are on the outside shoulder of each guard, and it forces single teams up the middle. the flexibility that Belichick had with Hightower and Van Noy, of course, especially Van Noy, is Van Noy can drop into coverage. I mean, he almost had an interception at the start of the second half in that game, and he dropped it. And that would have turned the game even more New England's favor. So, and this is something that Belichick's done for years, is he has these different fronts, and he puts players in different positions to succeed. And through the 2000s into the 2010s, he would switch from, I don't like to call it 4-3 versus 3-4 anymore, because that's not really accurate. I don't think teams run those as bases anymore. But he would switch between primarily one gap and two gap players at their point of expertise, just to make sure he had sort of the higher percentage of collegiate players coming out for whatever the scheme was at that particular time. So, you know, Belichick's a guy who throughout his career with the Patriots has just been so good and so astute at changing things up and saying, okay, this is where it's going, so I'm going to get there first.
Yeah. So what I'm wondering, too, now for the future, and because what that does is does some of the things that you see in college, it almost makes non-positional type players. You know, like, for example, here's Chung before he got hurt. He was playing on the line almost like a linebacker slash defensive end, and also with the ability to drop into coverage. But, you know, he was a safety playing, you know, multiple type of positions. I mean, is that going to be one of the answers for some of these exotic offenses?
Sure. I mean, look at what the Dolphins did with Minka Fitzpatrick last year. He played six different defensive back positions within Nick Saban's scheme. And the Dolphins didn't draft him and then just say, oh, you're going to be a slot corner. He was a slot guy, a slot corner, and a slot safety at different points in the season. And then they'd move him outside where he was also pretty good. I think the NFL is becoming, I mean, I've had different coaches tell me that it's less about positions and more, it's more a matchup league. It's like, can I get my receiver in the slot against your smaller slot corner? And can I gain an advantage that way? You know, can I run a switch release outside and your coverage doesn't work with that? You know, I wrote an article about match coverage, three-part article about match coverage about halfway through the season with Matt Bowen and Lewis Riddick. And we talked about how red zone defenses, you know, your standard cover one and cover three and cover two are not set up for modern passing combinations, for route combinations, and guys are still running it. So I think to me, it's much less about position. Like, I'm a linebacker, I'm a safety. I think if you're one thing at this point, especially on defense, you're at a distinct disadvantage because coaches and coordinators are desperate to find guys who can do multiple things.
So where do you put the Seahawks now with their cover one, cover three, and what changes that Ken Norton Jr. might be making?
They were more flexible. I mean, they were more flexible in Richard's last year. They blitzed more. They ran more cover two. There were games where they ran a lot of match coverage last year. I think Norton and his staff were more flexible there. They run a lot of what's called two-man, which is two high safeties and man coverage underneath. Cover one is a single high safety version of that, and you have a lurk guy underneath. So I think the Seahawks only run cover one and cover three. I think at this point that's a misnomer. I think it's an overgeneralization. And, you know, I've seen other teams, you know, the Chargers have been in situations, well, that playoff game against the Patriots, and that's where Gus is now. Gus Bradley, where they're running spot drop cover three over and over and over, and Brady was just killing him. And you wonder, well, Gus is a brilliant guy. Why aren't they adapting? You know, is it the personnel? Do they not see a way to get around this? But I, you know, just as the positional paradigm has become a lot more open, I think teams have to be much more progressive in their coverage concepts. And that's where you go back to the Super Bowl discussion we were having, where the Patriots were coming up to the line in one coverage concept and then moving it after McVay couldn't tell Goff, here's what's coming. I mean, that's a next level of brilliance that you would expect from Belichick and Brian Flores and his staff. And you tend to wonder why other teams aren't matching up to that.
Yeah, because when I made the forecast that, because if you watched, I think scoring went down. It was at the peak at about 48-4, and then I think it finished like at 46-7. It dropped about 1.7 points. And so I'm forecasting that it's going to drop a little bit more next year.
It could. I think, you know, I think you look at trends. The first half of every season, I mean, we had, you know, the Rams-Chiefs game, and oh my God, every game's going to be 50 to, you know, 47. And where are the defenses? And in, I think, the last 5 to 6 weeks of the regular season into the playoffs, certainly defenses came around. And of course, it's ironic that you have a 13-3 Super Bowl. I think it's the second Super Bowl where the losing team didn't score a touchdown after Super Bowl VI and the poor Miami Dolphins. You have a result like that where neither team can score. I mean, Brady was also struggling with some of the disguise coverages that the Rams were running. So it becomes this different thing. I tend to wonder if we're going to see a lot of high-powered offenses in the first half of the season again in 2019, and then defenses kind of start to figure it out again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I think you can see that, particularly after going down to see that 54-51 game and everybody saying, oh, my God, this game is so different now. You know, things have changed, and, you know, the defenses are catching up, but still, it is an offensive league, mainly because the league wants it that way. You know, they're administrating things that help offenses more than defenses.
Yeah, that's true. You know, the body on the quarterback penalties, those went way down. The league obviously had to self-correct after all those ridiculous penalties in the first month of the season, especially on Clay Matthews. And certainly in the Super Bowl itself, there were five or six plays where a penalty could have been called defensively. And I think the league, by that point, certainly through the playoffs, through the postseason, it was more a let-them-play thing. So that varies as well. I think in the first month, you had all those penalties, and then maybe a month of defensive players going, okay, I can't do this or do that because the officials are so whistle-happy and flag-happy. So that could have been a part of that offensive explosion in the first couple months, too.
Mm-hmm. No question. And so what do you see coming from what's going to be a very defense-dominated draft and the impact that it's going to have coming up next season?
Well, a lot of linemen, Quinnen Williams, Ed Oliver, these could be the first two guys off the board. You have Nick Bosa. You have Polite. You have a lot of really interesting multi-position players. You take a guy like Ed Oliver from Houston. He plays nose. He plays in a three-man sort of stack defense, but he also plays three technique in a four-man front. I could see him playing end. I mean, he's that quick off the snap. Quinnen Williams is more of a prototypical inside guy, but this is, no matter where you're going along the defensive line, if you need a defensive lineman, and certainly if you're the Seahawks and you want an edge rusher to either pair with Frank Clark or replace him if you're going to lose him, which I don't believe. I think they'll franchise him if they have to. But, you know, after Averill and Bennett were gone, they needed another guy. I think if you need any kind of defensive lineman, this is the draft where you just sit back. You know, it's ducks on the pond. They're all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
how deep you think it goes?
It's a bit more of a complicated thing.
Yeah.
But certainly that, you know, whether it's a tackle, whether it's an end, whether it's an edge guy, if you need more of a linebacker, whatever kind of defensive lineman you need, they're certainly there.
No doubt. But where do you see the changes? I mean, how deep can you go to get, a pass rusher or a defensive tackle in this draft?
I think, you know, I haven't studied all of the guys. I haven't gone to, like, down to the sixth or seventh guys on my list yet. And I've just sort of created – I have a top 75 that I just sort of got done today, and I haven't even ranked it in order. But I think down into the third or fourth round, you can get guys who can legitimately help you in the first season. That's how deep it is.
Okay, and then finally, what defensive needs do you think the Seahawks can solve, and how can they solve them with only four draft choices and free agency? How do you see them? Because I can see them really basically on defense getting at least one player at each position.
Well, they're not going to bring Earl Thomas back.
Right.
I think we all know this. And that defense without Earl Thomas is I mean, it's not bad, but it's problematic. It's the problem you have to solve when you have the best free safety in the NFL after Ed Reed, and then you lose him, and he's been hurt, and maybe you didn't adapt always as you would have liked. You have to get that guy. There are two or three free safeties who don't have Thomas's range but can do the same thing, you know, drop from 10 yards back, 15 yards back in coverage, can go to either end, you know, either side of the boundary. Maybe they get that guy in free agency as a short-term fix, but certainly they need a free safety. They need a free safety solution, and I'm not sure that guy's on the roster yet. Like, and they have some good players, but a transcendent free safety, certainly edge. With Bobby and KJ, you want to start thinking about two or three years down the road, who are our linebackers going to be? I think they're actually pretty set at defensive tackle. But they may, you know, they may choose to get a bigger sort of nose type guy. But certainly to me, I mean, the most obvious need on this team right now, if they're going to compete and go deep into the playoffs against some of the more robust passing teams, I mean, you don't want to play the Chiefs in Super Bowl 54 without a dominant free safety, because that's just bad news for you. So, you know, we'll see where that goes. But I think free safety, I think above all, it's the coverage safety is their biggest need.
Okay, very good. So, again, the book, where can we get the book? And also, what else do you have coming up that we can read?
Genius of Desperation on the internet and online and in bookstores everywhere. And working on, I did a Kyler Murray film study piece that went up yesterday. You know, the obvious writing about Kaepernick and heading more into pre-draft stuff, you know, draft prospect evaluations and things like that as we head up to the combine.
Great, Doug, and congratulations on the award. It's well-deserved.
Thanks, John. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Doug Farrar joining us. And, of course, coming back, we're taking your phone calls. 866-979-ESPN, 206-421-ESPN. It's the John Clayton Show, 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to the John Clayton Show on 710 ESPN Seattle and 710sports.com.
866-979-ESPN, 206-421-ESPN. Let's go to Rashid in Bothell. Hey, Rashid.
Hey, good morning, Professor. How are you, sir?
Doing well. How about you?
Not bad. Just getting out of the snow.
It's been awful. I'm sick of it.
I hope you have more mobility in your area now.
Right now, Wednesday night, it started to clear out a little bit. So now all I have on the main street to the left is just a little bit of snow. So that's good. I might even have to kind of go on the deck and kind of brush some of that off because, you know, if we're going to get another one coming up Wednesday or Thursday, I want to get as much of that stuff gone as I can.
Yeah, I know. Professor, just wanted to ask you about some technical questions.
Yeah.
So, because you followed this compensatory pick, so Seattle has 14 unrestricted free agents, and there's no way, I mean, except for, like, maybe Frank Clark might get franchised, they should do something with Justin Coleman and stuff. So, by all my estimation and calculation, at least we'll have, like, at least 9 or 10 players leaving, and so even if they sign a couple of them, we still should be in good shape for compensatory.
Yeah, but you got to understand that it depends on what they get, what they're being paid. For example, remember when Terrence Garvin, who we talked to this week, remember when he signed? I mean, or when he was not there. I mean, if you go minimum salary, then you're not going to be able to get much. Like for example, if Nico Thorpe leaves and gets minimum salary, it doesn't necessarily count in the mix. And so you saw that a year or so ago with Matt Tobin when he left, you get no credit for that. And so I would have to think that the guys of value right now, I mean, you figure that it could be, you know, over $10 million for Earl Thomas and $9 to $10 million, I think, for KJ Wright. That puts you in a third and a fourth, okay? Mike Davis, maybe he gets $3 million. That can maybe get you a sixth or a seventh. You know, Justin Coleman, if they don't re-sign him, I think he can get 5 or 6. You know, that might be able to get you a fifth. And then you start to look at some of the other guys, you know, again, you know, I think you could get DJ Fluker re-signed and a re-sign with J.R. Sweezy for $3 million or less on an annual basis for, you know, so that you can get both of those guys for $6 million. You want to keep them. And then you start to look at some of the other guys. I mean, they may not be able to get much in free agency.
Yes, and that's what I thought. But I was looking at our exclusive right free agents.
Mm-hmm.
That's like the more interesting list. So how does that work? I'm really new into this,
yeah,
like contract stuff.
Yeah. So now the ones that are kind of interesting, they have about 8 guys right now that are restricted free agents. Okay.
Yeah.
That would be Quentin Jefferson and some of the guys, Brandon Jackson and that. And, you know, on the low end, we won't know this until 2 weeks from now when they get to the combine and they figure out what the cap's going to be. I have it as like $2.02 million. Okay, so there's going to be $16 million if you try to keep all those guys. Now, you saw yesterday that they pulled one in Miami on Brian Poole. So I don't know if they're going to go with all 8, but you figure that Quentin Jefferson, Brandon Jackson, and some of those guys they'll stay with. I mean, George Fant, for example. George, in fact, they may have to put a higher. They may have to go over $4 million on him, putting a second round tender, so they don't lose him. So, they may have as many as $18 million tied up on restricted free agents.
Yeah, and also Jordan Simmons is also on that list.
Well, he's an exclusive rights, so that's just basically his minimum salary.
Oh, his minimum salary.
So
okay,
that would be
okay.
Like $570,000.
Yeah, because you can't let them go. I saw so much potential in him.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's going to be a great player. And Professor, Cam Chancellor will get his 5.2 injury guarantee.
Yes.
And so they would eventually cut him like they did with Cliff Averill, right, last year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, so, yeah, because they would take a couple tacks because again, if there's any time he could pass the physical, then he wouldn't get the injury guarantee. But I mean, now he couldn't pass the physical on the fifth day after the season, so he's going to get the 5.2. It's just, do you cut him, let him retire? Because then again, if you're him, you don't want to retire because you're going to lose the 5.2. So, but again, I think it's just a matter that you may bring him to training camp and then cut him in training camp.
Yeah, and the thing is that they did right by him and stuff, of course. And he's been a great soldier for this team, and
mm-hmm.
I really like his presence. I think meant a lot, even on the sidelines and stuff. So, and I think they should bring him back if they cut him and he doesn't play. They should bring him in a coaching or a mentor position because our safety group really can use the leadership, even if it is beyond the on from the sidelines and stuff.
Exactly.
And Professor, last question. You've been following NFL for like the longest time and stuff. Has it become more common that NFL gets us in its own way? And I say it because of a couple of reasons. With this Colin Kaepernick situation, no matter how you look at it, they bungled it up as well.
Right.
I mean, more teams could have asked him to come and join, and just made it public that we asked him to come and he doesn't want to play and stuff. And then this this disinvite for the combine for an incident that happened like 10 years ago, I think this is just plain stupid. So
Did you see now they're already starting to back off of that? They made 2 changes in that because we were talking about a first round pick that got into a fight at McDonald's. Now, again, it was not with a woman. It was just a fight, 2 freshmen fighting in a McDonald's.
Yeah.
And so they weren't going to invite him to the combine. Well, now they're inviting him to the combine and saying, OK, well, you can do physicals. It's like, you can do individual interviews. You just can't work out.
Yeah. So that's what I'm saying, that
yeah,
they need to. And I think this news coming out of Adam Silver and stuff, like resurfacing
mm-hmm.
and stuff, I think maybe a bunch of owners are not happy with the way Goodell is handling a lot of things. And they are Goodell might be gone sooner than you think.
He'll be there through the collective bargaining agreement.
Yes.
Yeah, understand, it's it's one thing that the league has maybe made a few more mistakes than they should, but also remember, this is try handling the 31 ownership egos, the Jerry Joneses and guys like that.
That is true.
Good luck on
Professor,
that.
Professor, be safe, and we'll talk to you next week, sir.
Okay, sounds good. 866-979-ESPN, 206-421-ESPN, The John Clayton Show, 710 ESPN Seattle.